now with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Houck.
Good evening, everybody, wherever you are in the world at this time. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, helping you find your courage to reclaim that which has always been in you. In fact, helping you to find the courage to claim that which you have always been, which is a beautiful, beautiful soul that you are. Very excited to be with you here tonight and every other Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, and any other time in between. I am Dr. James Houck, and if you would like more information about me, or maybe you want to leave me your comments about tonight's show, I just invite you to visit the website. It's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. That's all one word there. So www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And if you would like to be part of tonight's show, I really invite you to call in. That number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And just a quick reminder that these broadcasts are podcasted, in case you want to go back and listen again, or if you want to go back into the archives and listen to previous shows that you may have missed. Again, it's right on the website. Again, www.bbsradio.com, Reclaiming Authenticity. Now, for those of you who are tuning in for the first time, I just wanted to say just a hearty welcome to the show. I always enjoy new listeners, and I always just urge you to give me your feedback. And if there's any particular themes or subjects you would like me to talk about, discuss, and so forth, just drop me a line. So just a reminder for everybody who has been following me that each and every week, these broadcasts focus on the integration, and that's a key word there. It focuses on the integration of our spirituality and our mental health. And I place it all within the context of our relationships with ourselves, our intrapersonal relationships and others, our interpersonal relationships, and certainly our relationship with God or the divine. Now, I often share with my clients, and I've shared with this audience numerous times, but you know, for people who are tuning in for the first time, I always like to share my philosophy of how and why I work with people the way that I do. It actually comes from two deep-seated beliefs within me. The first is that I truly believe that people have the answers within themselves. And this is what I mean by that, you know, because you know the kind of life you want to live. You know what brings you happiness and joy and peace and contentment, and you know what doesn't. And so we are often told to look outside of ourselves to find those answers. And we just realize that when we go inside and we look in, we realize that it gives us just a wonderful perspective as well as a challenge to be able to work through what we need to work through in order to live our lives to the fullest with, you know, finding that joy and peace and happiness and so on and so forth. So like I said, that's the first one. The second deep-seated belief is that I also truly, truly believe that from the moment we are born and then some, when we come into this world, we have everything that we need for in this life. In terms of our talents or our skills, our giftedness or our graces, our personalities and strengths and so forth, the very, very best of ourselves. And yet, again, we often look outside of ourselves for those things that we don't realize we already have. And so the best we can do is to look within to find everything that we brought into this world, and to embrace them, or I should say, reclaim them. And that could be anything, you know, if a particular skill that you have, or you know, giftedness you have, or the graces that you have, or, you know, your own personality and so forth. You know, those things lie within. And often when we go looking within and we discover those hidden talents or skills and giftedness and so forth, we often discover other giftedness and skills and talents and graces and so on and so forth that may have been lying dormant, but just waiting to come out. And that's what really gives us the strength to be able to live from a place of healing and wholeness and peace versus, let's say, a place of, you know, versus a place of confusion or frustration or pain or whatever the negative issue is. And yet, you and I both know that there are times we may even go through some very troubling, even horrific experiences, such as at times we're just in the wrong place at the wrong time and suffering some traumatic experiences where the experiences themselves and how we interpret them just overwhelm us. You know, they just overwhelm our capacity to be able to deal with things, and we just we're left traumatized. Or maybe we struggle with the same mistakes or the bad habits that we've never really properly dealt with and healed from. Or maybe we even struggle to make sense out of our issues that have been handed down to us through our family lines. And I always enjoy working with kids on this issue because, you know, once they get a glimpse of, you know, hey, this issue, this problem didn't start with me, right? And it's like, no, it didn't start with you. And why do I have to sit with you then? Why am I the one in here and trying to deal with all this stuff when it didn't start with me? And, you know, they're often to blame. And so that's how they end up, you know, in counseling sessions with me, because their parents want me to fix their child. And I often turn it back on the child or the teenager. And I said, you know, you're not the problem in the family, but have you ever considered the fact that you just may be the strongest in the family to be able to heal things that were handed down to you, that your ancestors, your grandparents, your parents were unable to heal from? And once they get a hold of that, boy, you talk about empowerment. They sit up straight. They get really happy and they go, you know what? I'm not the problem. And it's like, yeah, you never were, but you are the solution because you're the strongest one in the family to be able to deal with it. So let's talk some more and really, you know, get down and some issues. And boy, tremendous healing in kids. But anyway, nevertheless, you know, whatever the issues are, whether it's been handed down or we're at the wrong place at the wrong time, whatever it is, these issues and the pain that they often entail, a way of, you know, if we don't take care of them, we don't heal from them, it's going to keep us from living the life we need to live to discover fully who we are at our core. That is who we are as souls. And as a result, we often live our lives from that place of mental, emotional, physical, and spiritual woundedness and pain, instead of from a place of healing and wholeness, peace, and love. And therefore, ironically, we often receive our deepest psychological and emotional and even physical and spiritual wounds as a result of being in relationships with one another. I mean, we are social beings, and we can't help but to be in relationships with one another, but that's often where woundedness begins. And whether or not the wounding was intentional or accidental, it is what we do afterwards. Once we have been wounded, or once we have wounded another person, that will either reinforce those wounds or find a way to be healed, and we can be free, and others can be freed from those burdens. Well, according to one of my favorite authors, Andrew Sung Park, he's the author of the book From Hurt to Healing. He writes, when people's deep wounds are not healed, these wounds will become vortexes of many troubled waters that are intertwined with their own instinct of survival and fear. And many times victims instinctively synchronize their wavelengths with those of their offenders. And unfortunately, they internalize their perpetrators' images and values and externalize them in treating their own victims. So in short, they begin to see the world through their oppressor's eyes. And yet, seeing again through their own eyes begins the healing process. And healing is very much a process. And so the difficulty then is often finding the courage to discover the sacred, which has always been you. And that sacredness is often communicated at times through our giftedness or our graces or our skills or our uniqueness. That again, what we have brought into the world. We come into the world with all those things. And it's something the Scottish Franciscan John Duns Scotus coined as chaitas. It's a thisness. And we all have this chaitas or a thisness. Especially now, the world needs people who will begin to value and honor one another's chaitas, their uniqueness, their thisness. Well, throughout this time of the year, despite the excitement and the hustle and bustle and the craziness of the holiday season, I still find that many people struggle to find beauty and joy, you know, often focusing on the external sights and sounds of the season to lift them out of their depression or maybe to quiet their anxieties. But there is a tremendous joy to be found during this time of the year. But I first want you, I want to ask you to look within yourself and see yourself as a beautiful soul. Hear your beauty as a soul and know your beauty as a soul. As my teacher is often fond of saying, that beauty is most often spoken with reference to worldly relationships and objects. And he says, don't use the word beauty with regard to the physical features of a man or a woman or an expensive object that promotes your status in society. And how beauty is perceived is a reflection of the mind's inner purity and goodness. But he also cautions and says, as long as the soul is bound within nature's laws of this cause and effect, this deep essence of beauty, which is the soul, cannot be directly experienced. And so it does take work. It is a process of looking within and finding that purity, finding that goodness, finding that beauty, which is our soul. And to be quite honest, many people find it difficult, you know, if not downright resistant, when it comes to truly discovering who they are as a soul. You know, it's almost as if they consider discovering who I am as being too high a price of a cost to pay in terms of what they have to let go of in order to take on something better. But, you know, when you think about it, in the end, when the body is in its transition, you know, when the body is dying, when the body's decaying, you know, whatever, however you want to describe it, we do have to let go of everything that we thought that we've accumulated in this life. You know, it could be degrees, it could be homes, it could be families, it could be savings accounts, it could be 401ks, even right down to those family secrets that were once promised to be taken to the grave. We have to let go of everything. So whatever we know, we identify ourselves with, and thus limit our understanding of who we truly are. But you know, basically, this is what reclaiming authenticity is all about. And it could be summed up in one of my favorite words, namaste, which I roughly translate, because I see myself as a soul of light. This allows me to greet your lighted soul of who you are, even if you have yet to see it in yourself. Well, speaking of light, this particular broadcast focuses on how the light shines in the darkness during this time of the year, especially as we are fast approaching the winter solstice on this Saturday, December 21st. And the winter solstice is often looked at as a day of celebration and renewal that marks the shortest day and the longest night of the year. I mean, the winter solstice also marks the official start of winter, which then lasts until the spring equinox, which I think is March 20th of 2025 next year. And on the winter solstice, you know, the sun's position is rather unique because the sun is at its farthest southern point over the earth and appears lowest in the northern hemisphere sky. And the winter solstice also symbolizes the return of light, and it's often seen as a time of hope and new beginnings. And there's this interconnectedness with the worry. And there's also something with the winter solstice that is associated with the cycle of life and death, that even though the ground may be cold and frigid and frost and everything else, really hard, underneath, life is still there. Life is just waiting to burst forth in the time of spring. And with the winter solstice is also associated with health and fertility. And at its core, the winter solstice really embodies a moment of transition, you know, a shift from this darkness to light. And following the winter solstice, the lengthening of days following this pivotal point, let's say, signifies this gradual resurgence of warmth and vitality. In other words, bringing life back to the dormant landscapes. And it is a time of introspection, where people and communities alike are often encouraged to contemplate their life's journey, let's say, or express gratitude for the past year's harvest, and even to set intentions for the upcoming seasons. But, you know, spiritually speaking, there are many ceremonies and observances that recognize this increase of light in the midst of an ever-growing darkness. Because last month, in November, Hindus and Sikhs and Jains all over the world celebrated Diwali. It's a joyous occasion. I don't know if you've ever seen it. I would always like to be in India just to witness it firsthand. But with its core theme of, you know, the triumph of light over darkness, or good over evil. And it's really the festival of lights that's held on the darkest night during the dark time of the year. And that's when people really need to be reminded of light. Well, how often do many of our celebrations involve light or lighting candles? You know, more than just lighting lamps and candles, it actually symbolizes a power of faith and the light of an inextinguishable hope which fills our hearts, that no matter how dark it gets, one little light can never be put out. It pierces the darkness. Everybody focuses on that one little light, which can get stronger and can ignite other lights. And the lights get, you know, lighter and lighter, you know, and begins to fill the room. But when you think about the celebration of Hanukkah itself, it also clearly communicates something about the human spirit that survives even the worst tragedies and allows people to rebuild shattered lives or broken institutions and injured nations. I mean, that's the power of faith and the light of inextinguishable hope. So again, be Hanukkah. And speaking of an inextinguishable hope, this is exactly the combined themes of light and hope for this broadcast tonight. So although I typically wait until after the break to take calls, I'm going to invite you to call in periodically before and after the break today, okay? Because I really want to, you know, what brings you light? What brings you hope? How do you make these, let's say, the dark days of winter more bearable? Where do you find that hope? Where does that light illuminate your soul? So again, that number is 888-627-6008. Well, in the past couple of weeks, I have noticed that many people are just being overly stressed out for this particular Christmas season. You know, from running around trying to find that perfect present to place under the tree, or maybe to finding the right tree, to coordinating meal preparations and travel schedules, people's stress and anxiety levels appear to be at an all-time high compared to previous years. In fact, it seems as though somewhere in my conversations with people, I often find myself wanting to say, yeah, that sounds like a lot of planning, and that's going to be a great time, but don't miss the joy and the gratitude and the peace of the season. And here's what I mean by this statement. One of my all-time favorite Christmas movies, or Christmas shows, I should say, is A Charlie Brown Christmas. It's been a classic ever since it aired back in 1965. And, you know, come on, we've all seen it. If you haven't, you got to watch it, okay? It's a simple message of a boy, Charlie Brown, who searched for the real meaning of Christmas and reminds all of us that living in joy and peace and gratitude is not just for one day. But when we live from our souls, we experience these things every day. Now, granted, this is a cartoon, okay? I get it. But with most cartoons, there are deeper levels of truths meant for people of all ages. In fact, there is a depth to each of these aspects once we place them in the context of relationships. And that makes all the difference in the world because, yes, it's true, that's where woundedness occurs, but it's also where healing occurs as well. Well, let's shift gears a little bit and continue this broadcast with a simple question. What is the weirdest Christmas list you have ever seen? Okay, what's the weirdest Christmas list you've ever seen? Well, last week I came across a couple of different letters to Santa Claus. You know, they always post them to get a kick out of them. Now, it's not that they're weird. It's more like they're cute. But they are typical of a child's Christmas list. And as I was reading down through this list, which I'll share with you in a moment, I immediately was reminded of all the songs we have about Christmas lists. You know, there's All I Want for Christmas is My Two Front Teeth, you know, made popular by Spike Jonze. And then I think it was Alvin and the Chipmunks did a remake of that classic. And then there's Mariah Carey's version of All I Want for Christmas is You. And then finally, there's Amy Grant's version of My Grown-Up Christmas List. But here's just a few children's letters to Santa Claus. They write, Dear Santa, I want a little brother or a sister. Because year after year, one of the most popular kids' Christmas requests is for a younger sibling. And as such, many parents choose to announce the impending arrival of a new baby near Christmas. And one particular child said, Dear Santa, I want a mermaid puppy. I don't know what that means. Maybe wouldn't it be better if there was a mermaid or a puppy than a combination of the two? But, you know, all likelihood, numerous kids do ask for puppies and kittens as well. Well, one little girl said, Dear Santa, I want a real live unicorn. Again, asking for a unicorn takes the classic request for a pony to another level. And one boy said, Dear Santa, I want a goat cart, G-O-A-T, a goat cart. Not exactly sure what a goat cart is, but aren't you curious about that concept? You know, maybe the kid might be onto something. Still, others, you know, would ask, Dear Santa, I want a gumball machine. And then as I got down through this list, I read, Dear Santa, I want a wheelchair. Now, whether a child is asking for a wheelchair for himself or for a relative, you think about it, a wheelchair is a heartbreaking holiday wish. And as I read down through this list, you know, Dear Santa, I want presents for my parents. And, you know, kids often understand that parents work hard and they don't always get the presents that they deserve for Christmas. And then reading a little bit further, you know, Dear Santa, I want a cure for cancer. And wishing for a cure for cancer is often a shared holiday request among kids and adults alike. And then lastly, Dear Santa, I want a bunch of hugs and kisses from my relatives in heaven. Certainly understandable. You know, when you're missing a loved one during the holidays, sending a hug or a kiss would make all the difference. So, what have your children or your grandchildren or nieces or nephews wished for on Christmas? And for that matter, what did you ever wish for as a child? Well, hopefully we grow out of these lists, don't we? Or do we? As we grow older, maybe our tastes grow or become, let's say, a little bit more sophisticated. So what is on your Christmas list? Have you started making a list, or, you know, we're down to a week, or are you one of these last minute shoppers? Well, imagine for a second, out of everything you've asked God for in your life, when was the last time you asked for hope? You know, as we're, you know, in the celebration, or, you know, very soon of Christmas, and then Hanukkah's Christmas night, and preparing for the coming of, you know, Christmas in 2024, many people might be getting into a panic over the realization that there's so much to do and so little time to get everything done. When was the last time you asked for hope? Because for many people, what is promoted as the most wonderful time of the year often becomes one of the darkest times of the year. And for some, this holiday season is a season of loneliness, being separated from family members and loved ones. Or it could be a season of hurt or disappointment. It might even be a season of despair or frustration and hopelessness. And yet, for those who know the stories of Hanukkah and Christmas, we know that the backdrop upon which these stories are painted were during times that were filled with tremendous darkness. You know, people in search of something to believe in. People who wanted to feel connected and accepted and loved for who they are. Their souls starving for something more than just the latest fad or trend, something that provides real nourishment for the soul. And this is where the message of hope comes in. It is a light that shines in the darkness. Hope is very powerful when it comes to sustaining life. Now, there's an old truism out there that says, we can live about 3 to 4 minutes without air. We can live about 4 days without water. We could probably live 40 days without food, but we cannot last 4 seconds without hope. Unfortunately, hope is a word that's commonly used these days to mean a wish. And therefore, its strength is in the strength of the person's wish or desire. But if you look closely in Scripture, hope is that confident expectation of what God has promised, and its strength is in God's faithfulness. It's always linked to what God does in God's timing. Hope is not a warm fuzzy. It's strong. It's an unshakable foundation. And this spiritual power of hope can help us overcome any trial, any dark time in our lives. In fact, some people often define hope as a lifeline from God. And hope is also understood these days as an outcome that makes your life better in some way. It can not only help us make a difficult situation more tolerable, but actually hope can improve our lives. Because when we're able to imagine a better present and a better future, hope motivates us to take the steps to make it happen. Well, as I said at the beginning of this broadcast, I would really love to hear your heart on this subject of hope and light, a light shining in the darkness. So if you'd like to call in, that number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And I'll be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Houck. Be back with you in 1 minute. Ray, welcome back. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. I just want to drop a quick word about the next Reclaiming Authenticity show of the new year, which will be on Wednesday, January the 1st, 2025 at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That particular show is entitled The Power of Narrative, Words That Carry Transformative Energy. The Power of Narrative, Words That Carry Transformative Energy. And, you know, storytelling is a powerful means of helping people find the healing and peace that they are desperately searching for, because it places their experiences within a context. It's how people find meaning and make sense out of what they've been through and or are going through presently. Because when you think about it, everybody has a story to tell. In fact, every person's life is a story worth telling. And every story worth telling is a story worth listening to. And one of the more interesting aspects I have found is that when people tell their story from a place of anger, they typically forget about all the other good things that have occurred in their life. You know, it's almost as if anger produces this form of amnesia, or at least selective amnesia. You see, when we get used to telling a story a certain way, we do tend to forget all the other things that came before. You know, it's almost as if it's conveniently erased for the time being. However, as we tell our story from a healthier place and we are healing and working through our issues, this also allows others to connect to the healthier places within themselves. So tune in to the next Reclaiming Authenticity broadcast, Wednesday, January the 1st, 2025, right here on bbsradio.com, station 1 at 9 p.m. The Power of Narrative, Words That Carry Transformative Energy. Well, earlier in the broadcast, I was talking about the power of hope, especially during these difficult times. And just here's a few examples of how hope is very, very powerful. You know, hope shines brightest when the hour is often the darkest. Hope also motivates people when discouragement comes. Hope energizes a person when the body is tired. Hope sweetens things when bitterness is often biting at us. Hope sings when all the melodies are gone. Hope believes when the evidence is limited. Hope listens for the answers when no one is talking. And hope climbs over obstacles when nobody is helping. Hope endures hardships when nobody's caring. Hope smiles confidently when nobody is laughing. Hope reaches for answers when no one is asking. Hope presses towards victory when no one is encouraging. Hope dares to give when nobody is sharing. And hope brings victory when we feel no one is winning. Now, historically speaking, people who struggle to find hope in their lives typically also struggle with symptoms of depression or anxiety. And there is a sense of hopelessness and despair, not only, you know, what has happened in the past, but also what might happen in the future. And that kind of perpetual illness is often met with the seclusion from the community, or one being placed in a psychiatric facility back in the day, which further compounded these feelings of separation and loneliness. You know, almost out of sight, out of mind. We don't have to worry about people. We've kind of warehoused them with their problems. But, you know, down through the ages, people who suffered with more serious mental health conditions, as I said, were often warehoused or often secluded in some sort of communal living situation and, you know, often exposed to very relentless, harmful treatment programs. And they were often told that, well, don't worry about it because you're never going to be able to live independently. You're never going to be able to work. You're not even going to be able to have a family. However, nowadays, we understand that regardless of a person's depression or anxious symptoms, a person can actually thrive in a positive and supportive environment. In fact, and studies have shown this, the more support one receives from family members and their faith communities, the more enabled one feels to begin living each day in the present, in hope. So hope is very powerful, and it's transformative when it's lived out in a shared humanity. Well, earlier this year, don't quote me on the particular month, but I read an article that looked at mental health first responders who had worked with victims, you know, in hurricanes and tornadoes and fires and mudslides and any other kind of natural disaster. And they found that there were two types of physical survivors. One was psychological victims, and the other were psychological survivors. Now, the psychological victims typically were people who tended to look at life more pessimistically, let's say, by interpreting what happened to themselves, such as a pattern or a series of unfortunate events that seems to follow them wherever they would go. On the other hand, psychological survivors were people who were more active and optimistic, and they looked to the future. Yes, they suffered. They grieved their losses, which is a very healthy response to any kind of loss in our lives. But they continued to persevere and to press on. Something got them out of bed. Something empowered them. And where is this hope coming from? Now, the interesting aspect of this study, I thought, was the way people viewed themselves, which had really nothing to do with money or their education level or how much they lost or how many loved ones may have died. Instead, it all hinged on the power of hope the person embraced in their lives, or in other words, resiliency. Now, to have hope and to have resiliency is to find ways to empower yourself in order to face the toughest of times and emerge a survivor. And this was something I saw way, 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 way back in the weeks that followed 9/11, when it seemed like the whole world was coming unhinged. You know, the Twin Towers had come down, a plane crashed in Shanksville, crashed into the Pentagon. And interestingly thing I noted that people under 40 were all beside themselves. You know, what are we going to do? We've never been through anything like this before. How are we going to manage? You know, are we at war right now? And there was this, you know, just overwhelmed with this fear and this dread. But yet on the other hand, people who are over 40, especially people who are over 50, you know, when I talked to them, they had this calm demeanor about themselves. Yes, they were upset that a lot of destruction and lives were lost and so forth. Yes, they grieved those things, but they would often follow up with this look in their eye and say, you know, we're going to get through this. We just need to look out for one another. We're going to get through this, but we're going to get through it together. And that made all the difference. You know, it's almost as if they've been through things before and their resiliency had been built up through the hope that, you know, they embraced along the way. And so they were able to say very confidently, yeah, we're going to get through this. Yeah, we have the resiliency. It will be done. We are going to get through this. So, you know, when people are hopeful and they have hope that things and people, including ourselves, have the ability to grow and to transform and to maintain that transformation, those changes, we are then intrinsically motivated to set goals and act on them to achieve those goals and reinforce that hope and optimism. So in other words, hope and optimism build upon more hope and optimism and more hope and optimism. And overall, having hope and holding a more optimistic view of not only ourselves, but also others and the world as a whole, does act as a motivator for us to reach our goals and to make positive changes in our lives and positive changes in the lives of others. And yet, hope is more than just a state of mind, if you will. And it should be understood at, you know, as a personal strength. You know, hope allows us a resource for motivation to not only pursue our goals and change, it also gives us the optimism and resiliency to pick ourselves up when things do not go according to plan. Yeah, hope and transformation go hand in hand. Hope brings about optimism and motivation to reach goals, to make and maintain positive transformations on a daily basis. And ironically, this brings us to another point. Embracing hope also enhances our capacity for forgiveness and understanding, which enables us to live in gratitude more deeply. When we're able to live in gratitude, it also opens up the heart to love more fully. I'm going to say that again because this is very important. Embracing hope also enhances our capacity for forgiveness, which enables us to live in gratitude more deeply. And when we're able to live in gratitude more deeply, it's eventually, sooner or later, it's going to open up the heart to love more fully. Forgiveness, gratitude, and love. And this is where the transformation shifts people from being a victim to being a survivor. And for that matter, being one who thrives. So how is hope getting your attention this year? How has hope gotten your attention this year? You know, I also counsel a lot of people who are in AA, you know, in recovery. And sooner or later, you know, conversations always come around to the steps. And I have to say, personally, I like the third step prayer, which is translated, God, I give myself to you. You use me as you want. Relieve me of my self-will so that I may better do God's will. Take away my fears. Take away my selfishness. Take away my self-centeredness so I can be an example of your power, your love, and your way of life to others. And this is the key to understanding hope. People seeing the potential for transformation and healing that hope offers. Well, maybe in your school days, you know, or maybe just one of your, part of reading, you picked up a book about this, but you remember the story of Anne Sullivan. You know, she was the teacher and friend of Helen Keller, and Helen Keller was blind and she was mute as a very, very young child. Well, before they became friends, and they did, they formed a wonderful friendship. Annie was hired to be Helen's caretaker and teacher. Because you see, when Helen was 19 months old, an illness, I think they've ruled it like scarlet fever, you know, had left Helen deaf and blind and mute. And she was an excitable, energetic child. You know, she showed such signs of great intelligence that her mother sent for a private teacher. And here comes Anne Sullivan, herself formerly blind, but managed to break through to communicate with Helen. And the story of just how it all began, totally fascinating. You know, initially, Annie found Helen in a dark basement, and she was locked in a cage. And so one day, she decided to start eating her lunch in the basement with Helen, and even gave her some of her food. And eventually, Helen started to respond to this act of kindness and was eventually brought up out of the basement where she was exposed to fresh air and sunshine. And Helen started to improve more and more and more. And over time, Helen started to do very well, and she learned to communicate and excelled in her intelligence. And eventually, she went on to school and she excelled in her studies. And I don't know if you know about this with Helen Keller, like she wrote of her life in several books that included The Story of My Life in 1903, Optimism, 1903 also, The World I Live In, 1908, Light in My Darkness and My Religion in 1927, and Helen Keller's Journal in 1938 and The Open Door in 1957. And in 1913, she actually began lecturing with the aid of an interpreter, primarily on behalf of the American Foundation for the Blind. Because, you know, all in all, you never know how a spark of hope is going to change another person's life, even to this day. Well, it's typically my custom to share with everybody just a brief story of Saint Nicholas. Because, yes, there are people out there that do not believe in Santa Claus or Santa Claus made up and so on and so forth. But, yes, Virginia, there is and there was a Saint Nicholas. And Saint Nicholas, he grew up to be a Christian bishop who helped the needy. And after his death, the legend of his gift-giving grew and grew and grew. And so St. Nicholas was transformed into the legendary character called Santa Claus, who brings Christmas presents to children around the world. And early life, you know, St. Nicholas was born somewhere around 280 AD in Lycia. It's an area that's part of the present-day Turkey. He lost both of his parents as a young man, and he reportedly used his inheritance to help the poor and the sick. And again, as a devout Christian, he later served as a bishop of the town in which he was raised, or the city. Now, there are many legends about St. Nicholas. And the one legend that I gravitate to the most is the story that tells how he helped three poor sisters. See, their father didn't have enough money to pay their dowries, and they thought of selling themselves into servitude, okay, or prostitution back in those days. And three times, Saint Nicholas secretly went to their house at night, and he would toss a bag of money, you know, through an open window. And the man found the money, and, you know, he's like, so, you know, okay, great. I have enough money now that one of my daughters can marry. And on the, you know, he kept doing this, you know, night after night, you know, with the three daughters and the three bags of money. And on the third night, the man saw St. Nicholas and thanked him for his kindness. And he also reportedly saved three men who were falsely imprisoned and sentenced to death. Now, again, several sources state that St. Nicholas is believed to have died on December the 6th, somewhere around 343 AD. And over the years, stories of his miracles and work for the poor spread to other parts of the world. And eventually, he became known as the protector of children and sailors, and was always associated with gift giving. Okay, connecting the dots. And he was a popular saint in Europe until the time of Reformation in the 1500s, and a religious movement that led to the creation of Protestantism, which turned away from the practice of honoring saints. However, Saint Nicholas, however, remained an important figure in Holland, and it was the Dutch who continued to celebrate the feast day of Saint Nicholas on December 6th. And it was common practice, you know, for the Dutch, for children to put out their shoes the night before. And in the morning, they would discover the gifts that St. Nicholas had left for them there. And so Dutch immigrants brought the legend of St. Nicholas, known to them in their own language as Sint Nicolaas, or by his nickname Sinterklaas, to America around the 1700s. And St. Nicholas went through many transformations in America. Okay. Sinterklaas became Santa Claus. And instead of giving gifts on December 6th, he became part of the Christmas holiday. And in the 1820 poem, An Account of a Visit from St. Nicholas by Clement Clark Moore, he is described as a jolly, heavy man who comes down the chimney to leave presents for deserving children and drives a sleigh pulled by flying reindeer. And the cartoonist, Thomas Nast, also added to the St. Nicholas legend with, I think it was 1881, he did a drawing of Santa wearing a red suit with white fur trim. Once a kind, charitable bishop, St. Nicholas had become the Santa Claus as we know today. Or, a story I like is that Coca-Cola got a hold of this idea, and they took Santa Claus, the jolly fat fellow, white fluffy beard, red suit, white fur trim, and they put a Coke in his hand, and Merry Christmas, have a Coke and a smile. And the rest is history. Well, I'm Dr. James Houck, and you've been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. And with only 7 days to Christmas, do have a wonderful Christmas Eve. Have a wonderful Christmas Day. Happy Hanukkah. Happy Kwanzaa. And may you always look at the potential in another person to spread hope, peace, light, and love this Christmas season. God bless.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding around to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Pacific, on BBS Radio TV.